House Judiciary come to order. Today is February 16th. And the first item on the agenda is the possible introduction of committee measures.
Chair Barker, I move that LC 297 dated 2/13/15 be introduced as a committee bill.
Representative Williamson moves LC 297 dated 2/13/15 to be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2330.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2330 comes to you from the Oregon State Bar. We've received all the paperwork on this. There are no amendments today. It is ready to move. This measure allows a converting business entity, a limited liability corporation, or a nonprofit corporation to file a declaration with the Secretary of State in lieu of plans for merger. And it gives dissenters the correct notice, dissenters' rights notice to shareholders who dissent via writing. Very technical.
All right. Kara Tapman, please. I hope I said that right.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Kara Tapman. I'm an attorney in the business group at Perkins Coie, a law firm in Portland. I'm here today as a member of the Oregon State Bar's business law section to talk about House Bill 2330. The House bill before you addresses two separate issues impacting business entities in Oregon. First, in connection with a merger, share exchange, or conversion, the Oregon Business Corporation Act requires Oregon entities to file articles of merger, share exchange, or conversion, as applicable, along with an attached plan of merger, share exchange, or conversion. Now, the articles are set forth on forms provided by the Corporation Division containing the most pertinent information regarding the transaction. In the experience of the business law section, including the plan is an administrative burden and doesn't provide a meaningful benefit to the public. The OBCA prescribes specific information to be included in the plan. While that information is necessarily part of the underlying transaction document, the underlying document typically isn't suitable for public filing because it also contains confidential information as well. So in practice, this means that entities, or more often their counsel, often create a separate plan document solely for purposes of filing with the division. This practice adds administrative burden and expense to the transaction. Also, because the plans aren't filed on a form provided by the division, each filing requires a detailed individual inspection by the division staff. The division has identified to us that issues related to the plan are the most frequent cause of rejection for filed articles, further increasing the administrative burden and costs of those filings to the state. So here, in this bill, the revised provisions would specify the pertinent parts of the plan to be included in the articles, including which entity survives in the transaction, and that, as mentioned, in lieu of filing a plan, entities may affirmatively state in the articles that A, the plan is on file at the entity and listing the address, and B, that a copy of the plan will be furnished on request and without cost to any shareholder of a constituent entity. The articles would continue to require the entity to indicate whether a shareholder vote was either obtained or not required, but wouldn't require a detailed breakdown of the voting results, which is, again, another attachment to the articles. The second issue that House Bill 2330 addresses, separate issue, relates to dissenters' rights notification. So a brief bit of background. In 2001, Section 211(1)(b) of Chapter 60 was added to provide that certain corporate actions under ORS Chapter 60 may be taken at a meeting that may be taken at a meeting of shareholders may instead be taken by less than unanimous written consent instead of a meeting. Section 211(6) was also added at the same time to confirm that a shareholder who doesn't consent in writing to the action has the same rights to dissent and obtain payment for its shares as a shareholder who didn't vote to approve the action at the meeting, so kind of corresponding rights to dissent. However, At the same time, no corresponding changes were made to the process for notifying a non-consenting shareholder of his or her its right to dissent or the procedures to follow to exercise those dissenters' rights. So this creates some uncertainty with respect to a corporation's compliance with the dissenters' rights provision. So here, House Bill 2330 addresses this by revising the statutory provisions to specify the procedure for notifying those shareholders who don't consent to an action taken by written consent of their rights to obtain payment for their shares in dissent. The bill also makes a clarifying amendment to Section 561(2) to remove some ambiguity as to whether that subsection applies when a shareholder action is taken by written consent. Our understanding is that the intent was not the case, and the amendment clarifies that Section 561(2) applies only when you're talking about a corporate action creating dissenters' rights that's taken without any shareholder approval. There are particular actions that don't require any approval at all, and we understand that to be the original intent of the subsection. So thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Thank you very much. Good explanation. Close public hearing on House Bill 2330 and open a work session on House Bill 2330.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2330 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Williams moves House Bill 2330 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Would the former member Perkins Cooey?
I'd be delighted, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2331.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2331 is another bar-related bill. This one we also have all of the paperwork on, and it is ready to move today. It deals with the Oregon Uniform Trust Code. It reinstates the early vesting rule, which allows the interest of some beneficiaries to a will or trust to vest upon the death of a settlor or the testator, and not at a later date. It also aligns Oregon's code with the federal tax code and federal tax guidance as it relates to separate shares and combination of separate trusts, or separating one trust into separate shares. It also allows a trustee to include capital gains in the distributable net income when the gains meet federal regulation requirements.
Thank you. Jeff Cheney, Philip Jones, and Eric Foster, please. Go in any order, but please identify yourself for the record.
Okay. Chair Barker and members of the Judiciary Committee, good afternoon. My name is Jeffrey Sheen. I'm an attorney with Samuel Jolin Cantor in Portland. I'm also the immediate past chair of the Estate Planning and Administration section. I'm here with my colleagues today as representatives of the Estate Planning Administration section, the Oregon State Bar. And we're here this afternoon to support HB 2331 and answer any questions that you may have. The Executive Committee of the State Planning Administration section supports this bill, and after extensive review and discussion with members of the estate planning community, we believe we have crafted consensus legislation within the estate planning administration legal community. It is our privilege to appear before you, the Judiciary Committee, this afternoon. And the reason there's three of us here is we've all played a significant role in actually drafting this legislation. HB 2331 will make four technical changes to ORS Chapter 130, Oregon's Uniform Trust Code. Phil Jones, on my left and your right, will address Sections 1, 2, and 4 of HB 2331. Eric Foster, on my right and your left, will address Section 3 of HB 2331. If there's no questions or comments, I will turn this over to Phil Jones.
Any questions? Please.
Chairman Barker and members of the committee, my name is Philip Jones. I'm an attorney in Portland, Oregon with the firm known as Duffy Keckel, and I would like to make a few comments about Sections 1 and 2 of this bill together, and then I'll make a few comments about Section 4. And of course, I'm happy to answer any questions. Sections 1 and 2 allow a trust to operate either as a single trust or to divide itself into multiple trusts. And if it operates as a single trust, it can, under some circumstances, operate with separate shares of that trust, one share for each beneficiary. And that is consistent with the federal income tax laws. This legislation would allow the person who created the trustor or the grantor, who's also the person who contributed the property or the money, to make that decision in the trust document. And it allows the trustee to carry out that intent, and it gives the trustee, under certain circumstances, the power to divide a trust or to combine a trust. The primary purpose is to let the people who created this trust, who have an intention, say if I were to set up a trust for my children, I could decide whether each of my children has a separate trust or whether they each have a separate share of a single trust. So that is the purpose of Sections 1 and 2. I'm going to move on to Section 4. If anyone wants to stop me and ask questions about Sections 1 and 2, I can tell you're quite enthralled with all of this. Section 4 involves the early vesting rule, which is a subject that's very close to my heart because I've written some articles about it. But the early vesting rule says that if a person sets up a trust or writes a will, the rights of all the beneficiaries vest on the day that person dies. I'm oversimplifying it a little bit, but not too much. And so if I die, my interests of my grandchildren vest, and my interests of my wife vest, and the interests of my children vest. And this is a rule that the Oregon Supreme Court has followed for more than 100 years. And it's a very helpful rule, particularly if the trust is misdrafted. A really well-drafted trust will answer these questions in using its own words. But if it's not terribly well-drafted, then we need this rule so that we can know exactly when this trust is going to vest and when it is not going to vest. And so this simply codifies some existing law. It clarifies some legislation that was passed in 2013, but it does not in any way take away from the 2013 legislation. It doesn't change it. It's just that in the mind of the estate planning and administration section, the 2013 legislation raised a question as to whether this rule was still applicable. And just to get technical for just a minute, if I were to die and leave a trust for my wife, and my wife dies 20 years from now, the 2013 legislation says that my children's interest vest at that time. And the purpose for Section 4 of this bill is to clarify the original rule that a vesting does take place on my death and that my beneficiaries vest and they cannot lose their interest in the trust simply because they die. Their interest would then pass to their own family. So with that, I thank you for your attention. Thank you very much, and I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Any questions?
Chairman Barker, members of the committee, my name is Eric Foster. I'm with an attorney with the firm of Foster Denman in Medford. If you were enthralled by Phil's discussion about the previous sections of this bill, you'll be very enthralled with my discussion about capital gains and distributable net income. So traditionally, distributions of principal and income from a trust did not include capital gains in those distributions. With the enactment in 2013 of the Medicare surtax, an additional 3.8% tax on net investment income, that was quite a game changer in terms of the taxation of trusts and estates. Trusts are taxed on their net investment income, and capital gains is included in the definition of net investment income when a trust exceeds $12,300 of taxable income. This is in stark contrast to when an individual beneficiary gets taxed on net investment income, and that threshold is $250,000. In addition, capital gains is taxed at the individual level at a 20% rate, when individuals reach taxable income, exceed taxable income of $450,000. As a result, it's become very important for trustees to be able to distribute out capital gains to individual beneficiaries so that trusts don't face tax at $12,300 of taxable income, but beneficiaries are taxed at either $250,000 or $450,000 of taxable income. So the solution to this is actually built into the Treasury regulations, section 643 of the Internal Revenue Code. And that section authorizes, and this bill authorizes, three situations where a trustee may distribute capital gains and include capital gains in distributable net income to a beneficiary. The first is an adjustment between principal and income. A trustee is authorized under this legislation to include capital gains in the definition of income when making distributions of income to a beneficiary. The second situation is if a trustee makes a distribution of principal, capital gains can be included in distributable net income if the trustee allocates the capital gains to principal, to the principal distribution, consistently and on the tax returns for the trust and on the books and records for the trust. The third situation that this legislation authorizes is distribution of capital gains that are actually distributed by the trustee to the beneficiary. And so with this legislation, the trustees will be able to shift the burden of the payment of high capital gains tax rates and the additional net investment income tax of 3.8% to individual beneficiaries. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions? The lawyers are all satisfied, it looks like, so that's a good thing. Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Public hearing on House Bill 2331, open a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2331 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 2331 to the floor with the due pass. Are there any questions? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Which one of the lawyers would like to carry this on the floor?
Got it.
I can do it.
Okay. Representative Williamson.
I'm right.
You should carry it, Mr. Chair.
Fantastic idea.
I have a half-hour explanation on the floor. Open a work session. I'm sorry, a public hearing on House Bill 2334.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2334 again comes to you from the BART. This particular measure, we have the paperwork on. We also have an amendment. We are looking at the proposed dash two amendments. We have a fiscal and revenue light statement because this bill has a subsequent referral to the revenue committee. It has a subsequent referral to the revenue committee because it deals with taxation.
Eric Kodish and again, Kara Tapman. Please. Oh, yeah, that's through the other one. Yeah, this area. Just remember to identify yourself for the record.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Eric Kodesh, and I'm an attorney at Stoll Reeves, specializing in tax. I'm here as a representative of the tax section of the Oregon State Bar in support of House Bill 2334. House Bill 2334 has been proposed to correct a procedural issue that has arisen to help taxpayers of modest means be able to appeal assessments by the Department of Revenue in the regular division of the Oregon Tax Court. As a background, as a general matter, when a taxpayer is assessed by the Department of Revenue, the taxpayer has the ability for an income tax matter to contest that assessment in the magistrate division of the Oregon Tax Court without having to pay any of the assessed tax penalty or interest. However, if the taxpayer wants to appeal an adverse decision from the magistrate division up to the regular division, or if the taxpayer wants to skip the magistrate division altogether and have everything dealt with in the regular division, the taxpayer, as a general matter, has to pay the assessed tax penalty and interest in order for the regular division to have jurisdiction to hear the matter. Now, there is an exception to this payment obligation for taxpayers for whom payment of the assessed tax penalty and interest would be an undue burden. And under current law, in order to be able to take advantage of that exception, when the taxpayer files their complaint in the regular division, they need to include an affidavit alleging, explaining the undue hardship of payment. And the issue that has arisen is when a taxpayer accidentally fails to include that affidavit with the filing. There was a recent case in 2013, the Scott decision, where the failure to include that affidavit resulted in the entire case being dismissed. House Bill 2334 has been proposed. It would change the relevant law, which is ORS 305.419, to provide that failure to include the affidavit of undue hardship would not be grounds for dismissal so long as the taxpayer corrects that mistake within 30 days of being notified. In the Scott decision, the taxpayer had thought it was mailed and didn't find out until it was too late that it wasn't. And that was the bill as introduced. There are now the -2 amendments, and those have been requested by the tax section of the Oregon Bar as well as the Oregon Department of Revenue. The -2 amendments will do two things. First, it will clarify the required date for payment of the assessment where there is a dispute as to whether or not the matter involves the type of tax for which payment is required. Payment to be in the regular division is only required if the assessment involves a tax measured by or imposed on net income. And then the second amendment would shift the obligation to notify the taxpayer about the failure to file the affidavit alleging undue hardship, to shift that burden from the Oregon Department of Revenue to the tax court, the judge of the tax court, to be the one to notify the taxpayer of this. And that is that basically summarizes House Bill 2334. I am happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair. Yeah. How big of a problem has this been?
I don't know if it's been a major problem. There was one. I don't know how many other cases there have been. There was one reported case of it recently, and if it happened, you know, if it happens to one taxpayer for whom payment would be an undue hardship, then the tax section just felt that the law it made sense to have a safety valve in the law to simply say. Not attaching that affidavit in and of itself is not grounds for dismissal. And so it was mainly a safety valve. It happened once. We're not sure if it'll happen again. And, you know, it may have been that other cases weren't reported on it.
Thank you.
Chair Barker.
Yes, please.
Thank you. Chair Barker, quick question. You said this, but I want to make sure I'm understanding it. The affidavit of undue hardship with filing, this bill would fix that. Did I hear that?
Yes. All of the rules about the necessity for an affidavit of undue hardship would remain the same. There'd be no change to that. It's currently the law says that when you file a complaint in the regular division, you either have to include with that complaint your payment or an affidavit of alleging undue hardship. And all this bill does is when somebody fails to include it, it gives the chance for the court to point out you failed to include this and the taxpayer to have 30 days to correct it. And in the Scott case, it was a matter of it wasn't, according to the attorney, it was not in the envelope and should have been.
Okay, so 30 days.
Yes, 30 days from notification.
Thank you. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're going into work session.
Chair Barker. Chair Barker, I move to adopt the -2 amendments to House Bill 2334.
Representative Williams moves to adopt the -2 amendments to House Bill 2334. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? If not, the amendment is adopted.
Chair Barker, I move House Bill 2334 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 2334 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, the motion passes and the bill is sent as amended to the Committee on Revenue. And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2644.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2644 comes to you from Representative Witt. We are still waiting on the fiscal impact on this measure, so it is not ready to move today. This bill deals with the Oregon Tort Claims Act and circumstances in which a person may bring a claim against the state for wrongful death.
Mr. Sahagian, please.
I'm ready to vote.
Good afternoon, Chairman Barker and members of the committee. I'm Mike Sahagian. I'm an attorney, sole practitioner in private practice for the last 32 years in Aloha, Oregon. This bill comes to you after last session. It was actually passed out of this committee last session. And as I look around, five of you will probably hear some of the same story you've heard before, but I want to make sure the four new members understand the full gist of what's going on here. So I'm going to just briefly give you a fact pattern of why this bill is necessary, and then, of course, comment on some of the more details in a moment. The first part is in May of 2012, and what you're receiving there is Steve Dean of Oregonian wrote about this, and you'll see his very last paragraph summarizes why we're here today. We've got a loophole in the law that I'm going to talk to you about in a minute as soon as I go through the fact pattern. In May of 2012, a lady who worked for Columbia Mental Health was sent out to deliver meds to a gentleman who was under the care of the PSRB. The PSRB had received this gentleman because he had been found guilty, except insane, in Deschutes County for attempting to kill his mother. He received a 20-year sentence. 3 years after that sentence was imposed.
Sentence? Did you say he was found guilty except for insanity?
Yes.
Well, then he wasn't sentenced to anything.
Well, he was put under their auspices for 20 years. My language was not, I guess, completely correct. Thank you, Representative. And PSRB made a decision to put him into the St. Helens community, and he was put into his own housing. And one of the things that was required that he receive medication, and he received that medication, again, from Columbia Mental Health, and they sent a lady out by herself, and she did not return. And when they went out to see what happened to her, she was found stabbed to death in this person's bathtub. Because she was employed, the workers' comp laws kick in, and I want to make sure we're very clear about this. It has nothing to do with any effect on the workers' comp laws. In fact, this matter has already been heard by MLAC, and they've determined that this is nothing that they have to worry about. However, the law does say that when you're injured or killed on the job, you can bring a third-party claim against somebody else who caused that. You can't do anything with your employer because that's the grand bargain we made with workers' comp. But you can go ahead and bring a third-party claim against somebody who may have caused your injuries or your death. However, there's a loophole, and this is the loophole we're trying to correct in the statute, that says if your death was brought about by a government entity or their agent, they receive the exact same protection as if they were your employer. And that, I found hard to believe, and I have been, like I said, doing this 32 years, so I called up an attorney who I knew had litigated this, and about 10 years ago, a circuit court judge had ruled that this part of the statute was unconstitutional and allowed that trial to go forward. And a jury returned a verdict for about $300,000 at the time. The state obviously appealed that up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled that this clause in the statute was constitutional, and nothing's been done ever since then, except lawyers telling clients, you know, if you were injured or hurt by a government body while in a job, that government body gets the exact same protection as if they're your employer. We brought this in the last session, and to say we got great support was an understatement. I do want to say, that's my segue, Representative Witt is one of the co-sponsors of this, along with Representative Johnson, or Senator Johnson, And the reason is because this is his constituent. And in Columbia County, this is a big deal. When this did not get through in the last session, it was the front page of the biggest paper in Columbia County, which isn't big, but it's the Chronicle. And it was the lead editorial saying this bill needs to get through next session. It's a big deal in Columbia County. And Senator, our Representative Witt would be here, but I understand he's very ill today. And I would encourage you to ask him about this bill, and I'm sure he'll tell you how important it is to him and to his constituents there. But this is a bill that's going to affect the state, obviously, on one level. Which leads me to my second point. The reason it got hung up last session is it got out of this committee, I believe, on a 7-2 vote, and I think the five members who are here returning, I think all five were supportive of this bill, and I appreciate that. But it got down to Ways and Means, and as you know, we had a short session, and we got down there, and there were some fiscal concerns raised about what will this bill really do fiscally to the state. And maybe I'm a cynic, and I'm not used to this forum, this body, but I truly believe there are outside interests putting doubt in people's mind. That's why it got pulled, but that's my opinion for what it's worth. It got pulled when it came to a vote in the Ways and Means subcommittee there. It got pulled at the time the vote was coming up, and the session ran out. In the meantime, we have, knowing where people are coming at us now, we went back and collected all of the deaths of people on the job in the state of Oregon. All of them in the last 10 years. And then we sorted those out because many of the deaths were, maybe it was the fault of the employee, maybe it was the fault of the employer, but it was not caused by any outside entity. And then we narrowed it down. And by the way, all this information has been provided to legislative fiscal, so they've got it now. And we narrowed them all down in the last 10 years. And maybe, and ours is one of them, by the way, there might be three cases in the last 10 years that have fallen into this category. Maybe, and I'm giving the benefit of the doubt, arguably there's only two and we're one of them. But there might be three. So I want to make sure I made that point clear, because that seems to have been a concern, certainly in Ways and Means Committee, as it should be. I also would like to point out that this bill has a sunset clause in January 2017. So we're only talking about a window here to see how this bill will affect the possible citizens who could fall under this. I will also point out that initially this bill involved anybody who was injured or killed on the job. Again, some powers that be, cities and counties, made sure that they tightened this thing up so it only applies to state bodies or state agencies. We've also tightened up where it has to be a murder or either outright murder or found guilty except insane. Again, we've really tightened this thing down as tight as we can. One, of course, to aid the family I represent, but also, quite frankly, get this bill through. Finally, and I think most importantly, I want to make sure everybody remembers how this family is treated because of the way the workers' comp laws are set up. And again, there's nothing wrong with that, but she has no recourse. This family received $16,000 for funeral expenses. That's what they got. And because she didn't have any medical bills, obviously, there was no treatment that could be given. And because of she wasn't married, she had no husband, and her only surviving daughter was over the age of 21, there was no other benefits. And that's what she leaves behind, a now 23-year-old daughter who has a new grandbaby. And so this family is hopefully going to be allowed if this bill passes. And by the way, all this bill is going to do is allow a claim to be made. If PSRB is able to convince a jury they acted reasonably, there would be no compensation. But this would just simply allow the claim to be made and see if PSRB, in fact, did act reasonably. And that's what we're asking for today.
Any questions? Representative Barton.
Mr. Chair, actually, I had a question of counsel who seems absent. Correct me if I'm wrong. We do not have a fiscal on this version of the bill. Is that correct?
It's not ready to go today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I recall last session a fairly extraordinary fiscal that raised some eyebrows on this committee.
That's right.
I'm looking forward to seeing the fiscal on this version.
It went the other way. I mean, it came back down.
Yeah.
Representative Greenlee.
Yes, thank you. As I understand it, this is basically for a single case, right?
Well, there's a single case that's creating the need for this bill, but I do believe it would possibly affect other families.
but for claims that basically have a... May I continue?
Yes, you may, please.
Where I want to go with this is if the public policy is wrong, then we ought to change the policy. If the public policy is okay, then we ought not change it for a single exception, which it sounds like what this is doing. So I suspect changing the policy produced a fiscal that was some problem, but it seems a little odd. I'm a newcomer on the Judiciary Committee, but not a newcomer in the body. And we frequently get into trouble when we try and solve a single person's problem with a statutory change. And what, I mean, you think the public policy is wrong? You think we should just be...
Do I think the public policy is wrong? I absolutely do. But that's not, and that's why the initial bill that we came up with said if you're either injured or killed on the job, then you should be able to bring a claim against a government entity if that entity is responsible for your injury or death on the job. I absolutely think personally that that should be the policy of the state of Oregon. What I've learned quickly is that if you want to get a bill passed, you have to compromise. And this is that compromise.
That's another question. I'm not sure I'm asking of you. How does it fit into the issue of the general liability limitation of the state that we have, right? I mean,
right.
I know it's been questioned, but the state still has immunity in a variety of circumstances. Is that right? Would this be an exception to that? Is it that immunity that's causing the problem here?
No, it's not that immunity. Well, it's not the broad immunity, or right. I think you were talking about the caps that are in place.
Pardon me?
That's what you're referring to. That has nothing to do with this. This just simply takes away the overall immunity, if you will, in this particular fact pattern. And that's why I make sure we're clear about. The fact pattern has to be you're on the job, you're murdered because of the negligence of a state entity, and then you can now make that third-party claim because the state entity can no longer hide behind the fact that the statute says they get the same protection as if you employed the person who was murdered.
I see. Thank you, Mr.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment that will really follow up on what Representative Greenlick said. And with apologies, colleagues, all of us here have issues that we really maybe get a little wound up about. As you guys know, this is one of those issues for me. I will support this bill because his client, whom we've met, the family, they've been through enough, and they really do deserve their day in court, and I don't want to hold this up any further. But doubling down on Representative Greenlee's point, really, the policy we should take a look at, perhaps in a subsequent bill. Again, I don't want to hold this up. It is, I think, wrong that the state declare itself immune, avail itself of the sovereign immunity when, in this one context, when because of a fault of a state actor, essentially someone is killed on the job. And the only reason we're able to do that is because of quirk of history. When the remedies clause, when it was adopted in 1859, workers' comp didn't exist yet. But really, that policy, I think, is just wrong. And I think that future victims, might not have such a dedicated lawyer. They might not have such dedicated representatives and senators as Representative Witt and Senator Johnson, who can actually help their constituent and their client that way. Those are the people I worry about. And again, don't want to delay this bill. They've been through enough. But I really want to echo Representative Greenlick's concerns. I agree with him wholeheartedly.
Thank you, Chairman. Representative Greenlick.
I'm really pleased to see this bill come back. Those of us that were here and listened to the testimony last time, saw the family, understood that justice wasn't done. And irregardless of the cost to the state of Oregon, do we worry about the cost to private businesses? The state has an obligation. And I hope that if you file, you win.
Thank you.
Chairman. Representative Post.
I have three questions, if that's all right.
Yeah, please.
And I want to go right off what Representative Barton said, and I'm new to this, this committee, and to this story. I've caught myself up on this story. I feel pretty confident. I've seen it. It's an incredible story. It blows my mind. But there were three questions that came to my mind as I've been thinking about it over the last 24 hours or so, knowing this was coming today. I wrote them down to make sure I get this correct. One, I think you answered the question, how prevalent is this? And you said perhaps two, three cases?
In the last 10 years.
Okay, in the last 10 years. So you answered that. But it led to another question of, I wrote this, in the interest of leveling the playing field is kind of what I called this. Could this be burdensome to the taxpayers, and will the cost outweigh the benefits? Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense, and quite frankly, it's the question. It's a broader question of the smaller question I answered. So I'm glad you asked that, Representative Post. You know, the first thought, if I may, and again, we're always concerned about money in this state. I get it, but there is a risk pool. Let's start with that exists right now. And these funds would come out of that risk pool. So let's start with that and work backwards. So there's point one. So does it affect the actual budget itself? I would argue not much, if at all. So that's point one. And I think right there, I can stop right there, but being a lawyer, I can't. So I got to think another thing. The second thing is, again, and I think Representative Barton, with his experience as a lawyer, will, I think, agree with this, and that is, the reason those multi-million dollar verdicts make the front page of the Oregonian is because they happen so rarely. It's kind of like winning the lottery. And it's kind of like, it's like talking about reading a lottery winner and saying, you know, I'm going to go buy a lottery ticket too. That sounds like a good shot. A stat that I can tell, and I can tell this as a lawyer, in Multnomah County, which is, I think, fair to say, the most liberal county in the state when it comes to jury verdicts, one-third are zero verdicts, zero. And again, the reason we get these big wowie jury verdicts that come to the front page of the Oregonian is simply because it's so unusual and so unique. And so that's kind of an expanded answer of, if I can get this to a jury, or what I really think would happen, quite frankly, if this bill passes, I think all of a sudden the state of Oregon will start playing ball, want to get this thing settled, and we're done with it. And then they can contain the cost. But more importantly, if it does get to a jury, let the jury decide what it's worth. And that's what it's worth.
Then you may have just answered my third question was, could this bill be potentially a means of accountability so that this doesn't happen again?
Well, thank you. That's the point I want to make. One of the things I keep hearing about repeatedly is that, well, if this bill passes, the PSRB might be a little more hesitant to let someone out because it's, you know, that they have that exposure. Okay, so, I mean, good. And yes, it costs them more money to keep some of these folks in longer, the housing and so forth. But again, I think that's the balancing that we do want, because they need to understand if they make a decision and make the wrong one irresponsibly. And by the way, that's the key word, irresponsibly. Because the jury might say, you know what, PSRB did the best job they could. We're not going to find them liable. But back to my point I was making is a very simple one. Yes. That's the way, you know, it could make them think twice, gosh, this could cost us this much if we make the wrong decision, versus how much are we saving by letting them out?
Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any question in our minds about the provision in the bill that says it applies to only to crimes after May 1st, 2012? Is that unusual that it dates back so far from the point at which
I think the bill would
be passed?
Well, I don't think it's common to answer your question, but I don't think it's unusual either. A lot of times, and I'll use it's maybe a bad example, but it's the same idea. You know, we'll use like the Catholic priest cases or the Boy Scout cases or whatever. They'll make exceptions to the statute of limitations, for example, so people who are now adults and want to bring these claims when they're kids can go back into time and still bring the claim because the statute of limitations has long run out. See, the problem with this is because there's a 2-year statute of limitations, and oh, by the way, another little government clause, when you bring a wrongful death claim in Oregon, it's a 3-year statute of limitations. If you bring it against the government, it's 2 years. Again, so our 2 years has passed, obviously. And
fix that too.
And thank you, Representative. And so, yes, we're doing it for that specific purpose. And by the way, as an aside, it got opened up like, well, wait a minute. If your case could be brought to life, are there other ones out there? Which is part of the fiscal argument, by the way. And that's why we did our research to go, well, there aren't that many, and some of them would be more than this just a couple years ago going back. Did I answer your question? Kind of. Was it good enough? It's not unheard of, Representative, and it's in situations where we're trying to correct a past wrong. That I think that's when you see it happening.
Any further questions? Thank you again, Mr. Shaggy. It's not ready to go yet. We still have some work to do.
I understand. Thank all of you and the folks I met with. I really appreciate it.
I talked to Representative Witt this morning. He was pretty sick, and he had to go home.
Right. Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2644. Is there any other business to come before the committees? Stand adjourned. Before the committees. Stand adjourned.